UK Wine Show, show number 215. Paul Fenner from Waiter's Friend. Good day to you. My name's Chris Scott, and welcome to this week's UK Wine Show. Hope your week's gone well. No soccer or tennis this week, but at least the weather's been great for Wimbledon. It's the first time I recall that Wimbledon's been played without massive rain delays, although I suppose the roof on the stadium has helped a wee bit. This week we're going to be talking with Paul Fenner from Waiter's Friend. Waiter's Friend are a leading supplier of wine accessories into the UK trade market, and also to the likes of you and me who like to drink the stuff. So we're going to be talking to him about some of the innovations they've got. As usual, we have a packed show full of all sorts of information. This week's Spotlight is looking at how white wine change colour. And as usual, we have our mystery grape variety. As usual, I'm going to give you a clue now. I'm going to give you a clue before the interview and then an answer at the end of the show. So this week's mystery grape variety is a low-yielding, late-ripening red grape variety that produces deep-coloured, full-bodied wines. Its home now is in Chile, with more than 4,000 hectares planted, chiefly in the Central Valley. But its roots are in the Medoc, which is surprising since there's hardly any in France now. It was cultivated in Bordeaux in the early 18th century, and with Cabernet Franc made the reputations of the region's best chateaus. However, it was transported from Bordeaux to South America before phylloxera, and it wasn't until 1994 that a lot of vines that were thought to be Merlot in Chile were actually identified as this week's mystery grape. If we think about that, I'll give you more clues before the interview. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Cheers, Chris. Foster's has scrapped plans to sell four Australian vineyards and a winery after reconsidering their importance to the group's future strategy. The company has already sold 20 of the 36 vineyards it had identified as being surplus to requirements, but confirmed that the Bailey's Winery and Vineyard at Rutherglen, Victoria, has now been taken off the market. The 150-hectare Guthrie's Vineyard and 246-hectare Schultz Vineyard, both on South Australia's limestone coast, and the 59-hectare vineyard at Meridian Home on the New South Wales Central Coast have also been taken off the market. The vineyards were saved after the company identified improvements in grape quality at the sites, as well as being deemed necessary for developing products for release from next year as part of the group's strategic brand planning.
The areas Foster seem to be keeping are all the coastal and the limestone coast in particular have a great quality potential, so perhaps Foster's are going to go up market rather than abandoning the wine market after all. Maybe they just can't get the prices or sell them the way they want to. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, Russia has barred the sale of tens of thousands of bottles of Moldavian wine amid a politically charged dispute over the nation's Soviet-era history. 40 shipments of wine from Moldova, totaling more than 170,000 bottles, have been blocked from the Russian market since June the 30th. Russia's top consumer protection official, Gennady Onyshchenko, refused to rule out a total ban on Moldavian wine, raising the possibility of a repeat of the embargo that Russia imposed in 2006. Onyshchenko cited quality concerns, saying the wine could be used to paint fences and was dangerous to drink because of toxic ingredients. He warned that control over the quality of Moldavian wine was slipping after improving when the 2006 ban was lifted. Russia's 2006 bans on wine from traditional suppliers Georgia and Moldova sparked claims that Moscow was trying to punish West-leaning leaders in ex-Soviet republics by hitting at their most lucrative exports. The ban on Georgian wine remains in place nearly 2 years after the countries went to war.
The fact that no chemical analysis was published and the terms to describe the problem were very loose, such as poor quality wines as opposed to anything specific, I think shows that it's a political move once again and shows that Russia is a very poor trade partner. I was going to have a look at Russian wines later on in the year, but I think I'm going to skip it now. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, the 2010 World Championship of Wine, the Concours Mondial de Bruxelles, has added further weight to evidence of a dramatic decline in cork-related wine faults. Of almost 7,000 bottles from more than 50 countries, only 1% were identified as being affected by 2,4-6 trichloroanisole, or TCA. This figure is consistent with findings from several wine events recently that have shown the incidence of cork-related taint to be either at or less than 1%. TCA contamination usually comes from corks, but can also come from barrels or other cooperage, or even apparently from wood within the cellar, including walls or beams. The term corked wine is applied to all wines with TCA contamination, because corks are the source of most of the problems. The wine industry estimates that as many as 3 to 7% of all wines have TCA contamination, at levels that can be detected by consumers. But because people are not trained to recognise the smell or taste of TCA, only a very small fraction of these bad bottles are ever returned to stores or sent back at restaurants. That's it from me this week. Don't forget to check out our website 3050.co.uk.
I agree with the results. I've noticed a considerable decrease in corked wines. This could be in part because I prefer screw caps now, but also because I think the quality of corks are on the increase. The only wines that consistently turned up cork for me nowadays are older Reserva and Grand Reserva Riocas. Next up, we have the Spotlight, which is all about how white wines change colour. Now, while red wines can occasionally be red, don't forget that purple and brown are quite common colours for red wines, white wines are never white. It's a bit of a strange one how we call different colours the wrong colour in wine. However, very young wines can be clear, sometimes green, and they can change to pale straw, golden, or even amber are quite common colours for white wines. Unlike red wines, which get their colour from leaving the juice in contact with the skins, white wines are usually separated very quickly from the skins. As such, many of the colour-giving anthocyanins are not passed to the juice. That's not to say that colour is not absorbed by white wines. You may remember that red wines are red, not because they absorb red colour, but because they absorb every other colour except for red, which is reflected back. But white wines tend to absorb light in the UV spectrum, which is beyond what we can see, with other colours simply passing through the wine, neither absorbed or reflected, hence they're clear. That's not to say that all wines are clear or even stay clear. They do contain small amounts of colour giving phenolics, and like red wines, these do tend to change over time. For example, young Rieslings can have a clear, sometimes greenish tinge to them when they're young, but can turn golden and even amber as the wine oxidizes and the phenolics polymerize. That's joining together. You see polymerization with colors and also tannins. That's how tannins soften out and one of the reasons why colors change. The acidity in the wine does have an effect. With wines with low pH, that's high acidity, and high sulfur dioxide levels, tending to bleach the wine and keeping it clearer for longer. Wines do take on colour as the phenolics polymerise and do change in colour to something more golden brown, as well as developing colour as the wine oxidises and the oxidation changes the colour to more browny colour. Another way for wines to take on colour is through barrel ageing. And if you want a really strong colour from barrel aging, the wine's usually been barrel aged after fermentation. The colour and other phenolics, such as tannins, leach from the barrel into the wine, turning the wines into a golden colour. It's a bit like how whiskey, when it comes out of the still, is clear as a bell, put it into a barrel over a period of time and it will develop that lovely golden browny colour. Exactly the same thing. But strangely, if the wine is fermented in the barrel, the yeast will absorb those pigments and they get locked up in the lees, the dead yeast at the bottom, resulting in a lighter shade of wine if it's barrel fermented, rather than if it's fermented in a stainless steel and then put into barrels for aging. Well, that finishes the spotlight. We're going to crack on with the show, though, and next up I'm going to give you the second clue in our mystery grape variety. Now, our mystery grape variety, which is grown in Chile now, was originally from Bordeaux, is characterized by dark fruit, cherry, and herbal notes, sometimes even having a gamey edge. And this is the potential to make fine wine. Apart from Chile, it also turns up in northern Italy, again up until fairly recently under the mistaken identity of Cabernet Franc, of all things, as well as in California. But watch this space, it may be heading for a revival in Bordeaux, where it has a synonym, or another name for it, is Grand Verdure. I'm going to give you the answer to the mystery grape variety. After the interview, which is coming up next, we're going to be talking with Paul Fenner from Waiter's Friend. We're going to be talking to him about how his business has grown, who his customers are, and what sort of products he's been selling to the world. Let's have a listen to what Paul has to say. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Paul Fenner from Waiter's Friend. How are you, Paul?
Greetings to you, Chris. It's nice to see you on this rather gloomy day.
What is Waiter's Friend, Paul?
Waiter's Friend Company, we're a specialist wine accessory company, Chris. And we're the leaders, really, in the field of introducing and developing wine accessories and wine tools for the wine trade. We also supply a lot of the major brands, a lot of the major wine brands and wine distributors with accessories and point-of-sale materials. So we print ice buckets, corkscrews, items like that, which are used as point-of-sale material to develop and stimulate sales.
Okay, and is it just the trade that you sell to?
We sell to the trade, but we also have a consumer division. I think we were probably one of the first people in the wine trade to start an e-commerce site. We've got a site called Wine Gift Center, and there we specialize in inspiring wine gift ideas for the wine lover in your life. So if there's a wine lover in your life and you're a bit stuck for a present for them or a gift, you know, you're going to Uncle Joe's 80th birthday and you know he's a wine buff, then our site is the place to come to, because we'll probably have a tool or a decanter or a gift that would be appropriate.
But you don't do books, do you?
We do a few books, actually. Yeah, we do Hugh Johnson's, Matt Skinner. We do contemporary books as well. Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay, excellent. Just to understand a wee bit about how your business is structured. You know, we're here in your offices in Guildford, and you've got a showroom, a warehouse, and an office all in a unit, so to speak. But you're not off the beat. You're a bit off the beaten track. You're not sort of in downtown Guildford, are you?
No, we're not. No, we're very much on a new, modern, dedicated industrial estate. Although that's not where we started out, Chris. I started out from the fourth bedroom at home, in desperation, I have to say, having lost my job and being 45, and really was at an age where it was going to be quite difficult to get back into the trade.
What were you doing beforehand?
I was running a cocktails and cocktails business. So we were doing cocktails and more spirits related premiums and gifts like that. So my dear wife, with three children and a mortgage, my dear wife said to me, right, well, okay, you've got 3 weeks to come up with to get a job, or come up with a business plan. So we came up with a business plan. Mm-hmm. And that, what I did was I went to Italy to the leading producer of good quality bottle openers, a company called Farm, who've been making the best Waiter's Friends since 1945. And I said to them, I'd like to sell their corkscrews in the UK. But they said, it's not possible. We do not have a market. We only sell maybe 100 or 200 in the UK. Is there no market? And I said, well, yeah, that's why I want to sell your corkscrews in the UK, because they're very good. And most sommeliers in the 80s were using probably a Chinese-made corkscrew, because it was very budget conscious. And they're not that good. The quality's not there. They don't have the opening ability. And so I really wanted to introduce a professional tool that would complement what the sommelier was doing. And so we took the agency for that, and we are still the largest distributor of corkscrews and bottle openers in the UK.
Excellent. Is it just corkscrews you sell, though?
No, we expanded from that very much.
Straight away, or did you?
We expanded in response to demand. We're very customer-driven. So as customers said to, well, look, great, good corkscrews, but could you get an ice bucket for us? We're very style and design driven. And if you looked at ice bucket design 20 years ago, it was very boring. It was traditional aluminium ice buckets with crown handles. There was no style. There was no flair to it. It didn't really think through that perhaps we might actually want to introduce a wine bottle and, say, a mineral bottle onto the same table. The footprint was all wrong. So we began to work with other small Italian companies. We began to design products which were much more interesting in terms of shape, in terms of appeal, and also which reflected the brand image of the big wine brands. And that was quite important. So, for instance, we saw a couple of years ago, we saw pink products being very popular, blush products, rosés. So we introduced translucent pink as a material for an ice bucket so it would reflect and enhance the brand.
How much of your products are designed yourselves versus how much have you sourced?
Okay, it's about, we design and initiate about a third of our own products, but we're just a small family company, Chris, as you've seen. So for us to set out and spend a large amount on R&D isn't practical. And the way we've got over this is we've worked in partnership with other small distributors in Europe, who are all essentially small family-run entrepreneurial businesses. And we combine together. We're watching the trends in the wine trade. We're seeing which way things are going, what's happening in the on-trade. And where we see a product opportunity, we work together and we commission a product, the design and development and the tooling of a product, and then we share the costs between us. And that way we can give a producer the volume that he needs, and we can satisfy our own markets. So it's quite a unique way of working, but it works well for us.
Okay, that sounds pretty cool. That's pretty cool. When did you move from the back bedroom, so to speak, into here, or did you come straight here?
We started off in the back bedroom, and I hired four lock-up garages just on the River Way, and we used to store everything there. So it would be a scurry from the morning down from the bedroom down to the warehouse to pack the orders and ship them out and then back up to answer the telephones. And that was fine until 2000 when we had the floods. And I went down and discovered the garages were under 3 feet of water.
Luckily, ice buckets float.
Well, they do, but not much else floats, unfortunately. The problem was I had orders to get out that day. So actually what we did in the end, I had a pal who was working in the city, but he was off for a couple of days, and he said, could he come and give me a hand? So we borrowed a rubber dinghy, inflated it, floated it down the car park, loaded the orders onto the rubber dinghy, brought the rubber dinghy back up to the car, took them back to the house, got Parcel Force to collect them from there. And to this day, I don't think a single customer realizes that what we had to do to get their order out. Key thing is we got the orders out to them and they got them on time. But I then scraped up all the wet, soggy cardboard. And I can tell you, it was 1,010 kilos of wet, soggy cardboard. I know that because when I took it down to the dump, I had to go on the weighbridge. So I know exactly, because I had to pay to get rid of all this cardboard. But after that, we thought it might be quite an idea to have our own warehouse. So we bought this place 5-6 years ago, mm-hmm. Fitted it out, and as you can see, it's a modern unit.
It's quite an investment, though, moving to even if it is a lock-up, but it is still a reasonable-sized business. Had you grown quite a bit, in terms of your turnover? How does your turnover grow?
We had grown, and we are very tight on financial controls, and we had the resources, we generated the resources. We don't pay ourselves big salaries. We reinvested continually every year in the company, and so we had the resources to invest in the warehouse, which is what we did.
What other products do you sell now? Because you've obviously got a good range of Waiters Friends, decanters. You have ice buckets.
We have ice buckets. Drop stop, of course. We're the UK distributor for the drop stop, which you curl up and put into the top of the bottle to stop the drips. And
we use them a
drops.
Bit.
You know those? You know that
they're,
product?
They're a great product, but really expensive for what they are.
They are, yes, yes. The Danes have a very nice patent on that, and they take quite a big royalty. So, but it's a good product, and it's well made. We do all sorts of products. We do wine coolers. We do some glassware. We do bottle stoppers. Sparkling wine has been a growth. We've seen a growth in sparkling wine products. So we do openers, we do stoppers, and we do sealers. We do products like that. And then we've developed some products. One product particularly that we've developed is called the Tasting Game. Mm-hmm. When I started talking to retailers, particularly in the early days, about why they didn't stock wine accessories and what the problems were, they didn't see wine accessories as an important line to stock because it didn't help them to sell wine. So we came up with
that. But they probably got better margins on wine accessories than wine.
Well, they exactly. Well, they couldn't see that, you see. Yeah. So, and well, part of the problem was the wine accessory industry was largely supplied by large housewares companies. You would have 2,000 or 3,000 lines, maybe had some wine accessory products. But they were mass-produced in China. They didn't understand the function, the form. For instance, if you look at corkscrews, take corkscrews as an example, we've moved from tin capsules to polylaminate and PVC. Now, you try opening those with an ordinary blade, and your blade will go blunt after a time. So we introduced the idea of a serrated self-sharpening blade to deal with tin and PVC and polylaminate capsules. Also, if you look at what's happening in corks, corks have moved away now from traditional corks, which are waxed. So there's quite a lot of, it's quite low friction. If you want to pull a cork out of a bottle, it was quite easy. Now with the synthetic corks, there's a lot more friction, as you know, because you're doing aquas all the time, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you've got to think that through. You've got to think, what is it? What is the torque, T-O-R-Q-U-E? What is the power that you need to pull a cork out of the bottle? And if you have a fixed lever on your corkscrew, then your torque is always fixed. You can't maximize the torque. So by introducing a rolling cam on the lever, as you move the handle up, so that the angle between the lever and the worm changes, and you maximize the amount of torque, which is why, if you see a sommelier using one of our waiter's friends, he makes it look so easy. So you've got to think these things through. And the supply industry, the housewares industry, weren't into that sort of R&D, which we do.
Are you an engineer or anything like that?
I'm not at all. No, I trained in the advertising industry, actually.
Okay, but you seem to have got the handle of it.
I'm enjoy inventing products. I've got a few patents for products. I enjoy creating new products, especially now at a time of recession. I mean, as soon as we heard the recession was coming along, we accelerated our new product development program. Now, people may think that's crazy, but now is the time to come out with new ideas, especially ideas which will help the on-trade to sell more wine, which is where we come in with something like wine flights.
Yeah, what is – I see something in front of me. It's it's metal, mainly metal, and it seems to hold about 3 glasses and a thing. Yeah, it's like a stand, isn't it, that holds 3 glasses. What's the idea behind this?
We're in a recession. Our restaurants are battling for covers. They're battling for customers. Anything you can do to make that dining experience a little bit different, a little bit more enjoyable, is going to stand you a better chance of getting a repeat booking. So with wine, especially now that they've actually finally decided to say we can sell servings under 75 ml. With wine, the obvious thing to do is what happens when the guy comes in to buy some wine when he's sitting at dinner and he wants the wine. He usually will either go for something he feels safe about off the wine list, or he knows, he will go for the second cheapest. Most people don't want to experiment. They don't want to try. They don't want to engage with a sommelier. Sommeliers are brilliant because they know their wines. They know their stock. They go to tastings. It's quite frustrating. If you talk to sommeliers, it's very frustrating to get diners to experiment a bit and to be encouraged to try new wines. Wine flights is a brilliant, very simple idea. All we're doing is that You do tastings every day of the year. You're into wine tastings. What we're doing is saying, take the tasting experience to the dining table.
Mm-hmm.
Say to the diner, we've got this wine and food match on at the moment, or you've chosen so-and-so. Here are 3 wines which might go very well with the food you've chosen. Would you like to taste them? You then take a flight of wines, 3 tasting glasses, with those wines, together with their tasting notes, on a carrier, which you're looking at in front of you. The sommelier takes that across the dining room to the table. The guy tastes the wines, and he can match the wines. And it's a great way to sell wine and to encourage people to taste more and to trial. You can either sell the flight at a fixed price, so it adds something to the menu straight away. You'd sell a flight for £20-25. Or what other people do is they say, well, if you'd like to join our wine club, and you get a flight and you get to taste these wines. The other thing that's happening is, of course, that the other diners are sitting there and suddenly the sommelier goes across with this carrier and he's got these three wines with the tasting notes. What's happening over there? What are those guys doing? It's a great way to sell more wine. A complete kit, the carrier, the tasting glasses, the tasting notes is 38 quid. Now that's, you know, it's not a lot of money to run a promotion in a house which will produce more customers for you.
Okay. I suppose the key thing, though, is you're selling wine by the glasses, so you need a venue that can manage those glass sales, really, don't they?
You are selling wine by the glass, so you're opening wines, yes. So you've got the problem, of course, of what do you do once you've opened some wine and it starts to oxidize.
Yeah, exactly. Which you guys have got the rights for Preservac, is that right?
Well, the solution, of course, is our low-cost wine preservation system, Preservac. Yes, which...
Sounds like an ad break here.
Which both handheld, it's portable, it's very easy to use, very easy for our staff to use. It's won a lot of accolades, and it allows you to preserve both still wines and sparkling wines. It's a vacuum pump system that's battery rechargeable, doesn't require any gases or any extra bits and pieces. The key thing about it all, though, is it's very, very easy for bar staff to use. From your most humble sort of spit and sawdust pub to a small restaurant, anybody can use it, and they can almost immediately do two key things. One, they improve the quality of the wines that they're serving. And two, they dramatically reduce their wastage. Mm. And that combination of wine flights with a preservation system is, so our customers tell us, is a winning combination. And it's low cost. It doesn't cost a lot of money to do. But in terms of your sales, reducing your wastage, it's a great investment.
Okay. What other products have you guys innovated? Have you done anything else?
Yes, we have. One or two I can't talk about at the moment because they're on the secret list, but we've got some great new ideas coming up for things. The other area we've worked on quite successfully is back bar display. Mm-hmm. So looking at very simple ways for displaying bottles and changing them around. So when a customer comes in, you actually see the bottle and the label, and that's quite important. Slow flows, you do tastings. One of the things I noticed when I first looked at wine tastings 20 years ago was it's quite difficult. You've got a crowded table, a lot of people around, all holding their glasses out. It's quite difficult to pour a measured pour. In fact, I'd say it's impossible to do, to pour the same amount each time. And we looked at that, and we came up with a product called Slow Flow, which is our own registration, and it's a simple constriction device. It's two parts, a little stem, you know them, with a cap. You put it into the bottle, nobody can see it, but it controls the flow and it allows you to pour a measured flow each time. And financial directors in the wine trade love it because it means the salesmen don't indent for nearly so many cases as they used to.
What I want is something that pours fast.
Which they do.
Well, not as fast. That gives me an exact measure, so I can just go like a shot
measure
for a whiskey.
Watch this space. Okay. I won't say anymore.
All right, that's what I want. You get one of those.
Watch this space.
You get one, and you tell me about it, and I'll buy some.
I think you won't be disappointed.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, I want a fast pour of an exact measure that I can control.
Another little product which we came out with, again, we looked at what was happening in hotel minibars with bottle openers, because inevitably what happens, people go and stay in a hotel and they take the bottle opener with them. They take it home as a souvenir, much as they take the shower cap and the soap and the other bits and pieces. So we came up with the idea of a folding bottle opener. I'm just going to hold one now. Pass one to you.
I've seen these.
Very, very simple. Folding bottle opener that is also, it's both two things. It's a bottle opener, so it'll open a crown cork bottle, and it's also a very simple little corkscrew. Mm-hmm. We call it Thirst Aid. That's our own registered name. It's very simple to use. It's the ideal thing if you pop it in your purse or your glove compartment or your pocket of your car. You're at Glyndebourne or you're out picnicking or camping, as we've been discussing earlier. And it's just a great little pocket corkscrew. And it's ideal for mini bars. Very, very low cost. And we sell it by the thousand to hotel groups to pop into their minibar. So that was a good little product. Simple, nothing complicated about it, but it does a job.
Yeah.
And it also allows them to put their branding on it so they can advertise their...
No lever, though. It requires a bit of strength.
Yes, it's not as good as a proper waiter's friend, but...
Yeah, you can get the bottle out. It's better than trying to smash the bottle to get to the wine.
It's much better than doing that.
Excellent. All right, then, Paul. One last question. Just see how you're getting on with the recession, so to speak. How's it affected you guys? We're out of it.
We're technically out of it. Trade is down, and I think it is right across the wine trade. People still need to promote. They still need to market their products. So if you can offer them low-cost ways to do that, then I think the future is bright. And I think things like wine flight, wine preservation are so essential, they're so necessary. People need to be thinking along those lines. So we're finding sales are quite buoyant for those sort of lines, but are down perhaps in other areas. As the big wine boys at the moment, they're watching their marketing budgets. They're told to watch their costs, and so the spend isn't there, but I'm sure it'll come back.
Excellent. All right then, Paul, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Hope you're enjoying that interview with Paul. Recorded the show about 2 or 3 months ago, and since then he's released some interesting new ice buckets and things like that. Hasn't mentioned to me the way of doing a fast pour, giving an accurate measure though, which is something I'm desperately keen to find out about. Just thought I'd mention, if you've been listening to the show and you like it, don't forget to put a review up, either in iTunes or some other podcasting aggregator. It'd be great to see some more reviews up there. I like to troll through them occasionally and see what people say. And if you want to send me any information or any notes or anything like that, do get in contact. My email address is chris.scott@3050.co.uk. That's chris.scott@thirtyfity.co.uk. We're almost finished with the show this week. Just a few more wee things. The answer to our mystery grape variety was, of course, Carmenere. That was the variety that Chileans thought was Merlot for ages, but in fact it was Carmenere. And one last thing is our quote. This time it's from Louis Pasteur, the famous French, I'm not sure if you'd call him a biologist or a chemist, but famous French scientist anyway. Anyway, he reckons that a bottle of wine contains more philosophy than all the books in the world. Nice wee statement, particularly when you're sitting on a balcony, sunset, drinking a bottle of wine. There's a lot of philosophical moments in that. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.